Good morning, and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. This Saturday marks the 25th World AIDS Day. The first such day was established in 1988 to raise awareness of the AIDS pandemic caused by the spread of HIV infection. Between 1981 and 2007, more than 25 million people died from AIDS. But more and more people today are living with HIV. Research has led to medical regimens that make it more of a chronic disease to be controlled rather than the almost certain death sentence it once was. Still, globally, an estimated 33.3 million people are HIV positive, and AIDS still takes close to 2 million people each year, more than half of them in sub-Saharan Africa. Today on Focus, we discuss the state of HIV and AIDS research, what it's like to live HIV positive, the strides taken so far in combating HIV and AIDS, and the challenges that lay ahead. And we have two guests with us this morning. Mike Benner is director of the Greater Community AIDS Project, or GCAP. The organization's mission is to improve the lives of those living with HIV and AIDS and help decrease the spread of the disease through educational outreach. GCAP also provides support to those living with HIV and AIDS, from transitional housing to emergency financial assistance and more. Mike Benner, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much, Craig. It's a pleasure being here today.
Glad to have you with us. And Dr. Richard Novak is a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He founded and directs the UIC HIV AIDS Project, a network of eight HIV community-based clinical and research sites throughout Chicago. He is among many researchers actively pursuing an HIV AIDS vaccine. Dr. Novak, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And we welcome you to the conversation as well. We are going to talk about the state of research, treatment, education, and services surrounding HIV and AIDS here across the country and worldwide, and how the challenges and narrative surrounding the disease has changed over the years. And we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You could also email us at will-talk@illinois.org. And you can post questions to our Facebook page. We're at Will Radio TV Online, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Mike, let's start here. What's it like in 2012 America to live with HIV?
I think we are in a very good position to be living with HIV. I mean, it's so much different than it was, say, when I first learned about the disease in the early 80s. I mean, being HIV positive myself and having been for 10 years, I mean, I really carry on pretty much normal life. Yes, I do take meds, but there's so many wraparound services. The care that you receive from both your case managers, medical, through the Care Connect, through your infectious disease doctors has really made such a difference. And I'm seeing fewer and fewer people that are ending up in emergency rooms.
Is there something about the experience that people who are not HIV positive maybe do not understand or know that's worth sharing or explaining?
Oh, I think the biggest one is the fact that, I mean, it is still has a perception that it's something, a dirty disease, that, I mean, that people just, I think a lot of it's just the lack of education about the disease. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not nearly what it was back in the 80s, but still there's a lot of people that are kind of like standoffish about the whole thing. So part of my job, both at working for GCAP and as somebody living with HIV, is to help educate people.
So if anything, maybe the biggest issues are human issues, dealing with other people and how they relate to you and how that like changes a little bit.
Right, exactly.
Once they know you're HIV positive.
Exactly. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I have a lot of family support and friends support. But, I mean, there's a lot of people out there in the community that don't have the kind of support that I have, which, I mean, that's where GCAP comes in handy. At least we are a family of people that care, and so they know they're not alone in the community with this disease.
Dr. Novak, what exactly happens in the body when someone becomes HIV positive?
Well, you know, HIV is a viral infection, so when somebody first becomes HIV infected, they may or may not have a symptomatic disease, which means they may feel something. They may have a flu-like illness. About half the people who get HIV initially will have a flu-like illness, and the others don't. They have no symptoms. And then that usually goes away. And HIV works by attacking the immune system, and it's a very slow, slowly progressive infection. So the damage that's done is slow to progress, and on average it still takes almost 10 years for somebody to develop AIDS from the time they get HIV infected. The first time. During that time, the virus is not quiescent. It's not hiding. It's still there, and it's actively doing its damage. It's just that the damage is slow. And so our goals are to try and detect people who have the infection early on and get them into treatment sooner rather than later and not wait for them to develop clinical illness.
Mike, what are the most important steps someone who learns they become HIV positive that they should take?
I mean, the first most important thing is to get into some kind of treatment program. I mean, talk with your case managers. I mean, Champaign-Urbana Public Health District has some awesome people there to help with navigating the care system. And then seeing your doctor on a regular basis. I mean, start that conversation with your doctor, finding out, is it time for me to start my medication? The treatment, as the doctor will probably agree with, is like you start as soon as possible because you don't want to have your body become, the immune system become too compromised. I mean, so that way you can stay strong and healthy as long as possible.
Dr. Novak, what are the treatments that, people undergo today? And how is it different from 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago?
Well, I've been involved with HIV care for over 25 years. So I recall a time when we didn't have any treatment and people died of AIDS. That doesn't happen anymore. Initially, we just had a single drug, AZT, to treat HIV, and the benefits were short-lived, and people then went on to progress to AIDS and die. And then, but over the course of the last 20 years, 25 years, we've had a gradually increasing number of drugs added to our armamentarium to treat the disease, and the treatments we have are much easier to use nowadays. They have fewer side effects. They are dosed less frequently. In this day and age, we have a number of combination therapies, or three drugs and one pill, that people can take once a day, and that's essentially the whole treatment, one pill once a day. And for people who are newly infected who go on these treatments, that will control their disease indefinitely as long as they stay on it.
Are there
so it's
different?
Very easy.
Are there different combinations for different patients, or is it all ultimately you combine these three drugs into this one pill, and that kind of works for everybody?
Well, there are a variety of different combinations and drugs. There are drugs that have different mechanisms of action. They attack the virus in different places. We usually try and combine drugs that attack the virus in more than one place. They work by different means and. One of the considerations that we use are, I mean, there are a number of things that we have to take into account, the person's lifestyle and what's convenient for them, what other medical conditions they might have coexisting with their HIV, and also one of the concerns is they may have acquired a virus that is resistant to one or more of the drugs. Since HIV drugs have been around for a very long time, there are a number of people walking around who have viruses that are already have acquired resistance to drugs, and then they can transmit those to other people. And so people who are newly infected may start their infection with a virus already resistant to some of the medications.
Is that sort of the great concern going forward, that new strains may develop that are resistant to any drugs that have been developed thus far?
Well, that was a concern. It's actually become less of a problem more in recent years because of these combination drugs. One of the beauties of providing the drugs in combination is that people either have to take all of them or none of them. And one of the problems in the past was that people would take only some of their medication and they would be more likely to develop resistance because they weren't fully suppressing the virus. When you're inclined to take all the medication, you will suppress the virus, and then if you go off it for some reason, you're off everything. And so actually what's happened is we're seeing a little bit less resistance now than we had about 5 years ago.
Mike, one
but
of
it's still a concern.
One of the things you and I were talking about before the program was this notion of drug holidays, that some people who are HIV positive will decide maybe the side effects at some point are too great and they need a break. And that's probably a very unwise idea.
Oh, it is. I mean, with the modern medications, the newer ones, I mean, it's not quite so much an issue. But in the early days, especially with AZT, I mean, they were dosing that at such high rates that people were just getting violently ill. And it's just like they just said, no more. I can't handle this anymore. Anymore now that people are taking, so many people are taking the once-a-day pill or even maybe only three or four pills a day. It makes it a lot easier.
So is a key step to stress, somebody becomes HIV positive and start on this drug regimen, you stay on that, but you take that pill every day no matter what?
Oh, you have to take it every day. I mean, that's unlike some other chronic illnesses like diabetes where you know immediately if you don't take your insulin, HIV, you might not know that you're having any side effects from not taking your medicine for several days. So, I mean, you just have to stay with it and work through those side effects.
I gave the short description earlier, but flesh out for us what GCAP is, what it does. You mentioned that there are a variety of services available for people who are HIV positive. What role does GCAP play?
Well, GCAP has been around since 1985. We originally started as the Gay Community AIDS Project by members of the gay community because they're seeing what it was doing to all their friends and family members. Eventually, we morphed into the Greater Community AIDS Project just to kind of make the organization sound more encompassing, not that we weren't. We're always serving the entire community, but they're just the names that people felt comfortable coming to us. Anymore, we do have emergency financial assistance for people that may be short on the rent money, their utilities, a medical copay, or something as simple as maybe needing a car repair so they can get to the doctor or a bus pass. We have two different housing facilities, a transitional house for people that are either homeless or in danger of becoming homeless. We have a permanent housing facility that has three apartments. We offer a food bank once a month for all of our clients. And then we also do a lot of community outreach to talk to people about HIV. Me being the sole person in the office, usually when somebody calls, gets to talk to me. So, I mean, they really enjoy having somebody that is actually living the same experience that they are to be able to have a discussion with. And while I'm not a medical case manager by any means, I can give my own personal story and how I've managed to deal with the disease.
You mentioned the name change. I wonder if some of that, whether it was intentional or not, does it reflect also the fact that the face of HIV and AIDS has changed, that what was once so significantly associated with the gay community in the 1980s, because the spread was so strong within that community at that time, other populations are seeing greater spreads of this infection today, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, our client base has changed considerably over just the 3 or 4 years that I've worked for the organization. We're seeing a lot more women, a lot more heterosexual African-American men. I mean, so it's really running the gamut that whereas back in the early days, I mean, almost, I didn't know anybody that was not gay that was having the disease. It wasn't until towards the late 80s that I started finding out people like the hemophiliacs and people who had blood transfusions that were also being affected. Right. I mean, even though I knew that that was going on, I wasn't aware of anybody that was in that situation.
Dr. Novak, you started the UIC HIV AIDS Project back in 1989. How has its mission evolved over the years?
Well, actually, so we also had a name change. We're now called the HIV Community Clinic Network. And we serve primarily indigent minority populations of Chicago's south and west sides, although we have clinics on the north side, the northwest side. We're actually all over town. Our patient population is much more more of a diverse population. It's 40% women, actually, and most of those women acquired HIV through heterosexual contact. And then we have a substantial number of men who have sex with men. What we're seeing is the change in trends in the HIV epidemic in an urban area like Chicago is a much larger number of young men, primarily African-American men who have sex with men, who are acquiring the disease, and it's increasing at a disturbing rate. So our efforts are really focusing more on youth, on the youth populations, and particularly on women, because while we have really effective treatments for HIV, there are a number of barriers for people actually taking the drugs, and a lot of those are things like poverty and mental health issues. So we are trying to focus more on finding ways to improve retention and care for our higher-risk patients.
Mike, what can be done to address those issues?
A common problem that we have, for example, is among our women who are often come to become HIV diagnosed when they come in for prenatal care. And it's part of the prenatal visit that they get HIV tested. They're found to be positive. They usually then enter HIV treatment primarily with the goal of preventing mother-to-child transmission, and that's usually pretty effective. Almost all women adhere to that regimen. They have to go on medication, usually in the third trimester and through the delivery, to prevent transmission to their newborn babies. But after that, after their delivery, they're often lost to care. They disappear from the system, and they women often are far more preoccupied with the health and welfare of their children rather than themselves. And so they tend to fall out of care. So a lot of our efforts are, we use community-based outreach and case management. Mental health is a very important part of that equation for trying to retain women in care. We're starting a program now that will offer child care at our site, and we're trying to have comprehensive services for women and their children in the same site so that there'll be more of an attraction for them to come in, that they can get their children cared for at the same time that they receive care.
And that sounds like a fantastic idea. I mean, just that basically that one-stop shopping type thing, that the when the child goes in for his health care, the mother also gets her health care. So I can binge you on that job.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the state of HIV and AIDS research, what it's like to live HIV positive, strides taken so far in combating HIV and AIDS, and the challenges that lay ahead. This Saturday is the 25th World AIDS Day. My guests are Mike Benner, director of the Greater Community AIDS Project, or GCAP, and Dr. Richard Novak, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter accounts. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Dr. Novak, what are you currently researching related to HIV and AIDS?
Well, I have a number of different projects, but the largest, my largest research focus is on developing HIV preventive vaccines. I am the University of Illinois Chicago is part of a large international network called the HIV Vaccine Trials Network. It's involved in developing and testing preventive vaccines worldwide, and it's we're currently engaged in a vaccine trial that's targeting men who have sex with men, and it's going to be fully enrolled by March, hopefully, of next year. We'll include about 2,500 individuals throughout the United States. And we're optimistic, we're hopeful that we're going to see some benefit from this vaccine.
What precisely makes you hopeful about this vaccine versus past ones that you've attempted to bring to clinical trials?
That's a good question. So I've been involved with HIV vaccine research for the last 17 years, and it's been a very slow and frustrating process. And we've conducted a number of trials that were that didn't show positive results of preventing infections. But we've learned a little bit from each one of those trials, and more recently there was a large study that was completed in Thailand. It showed a weekly positive signal, meaning the vaccine was weekly protective, about 30% efficacy. That was a major breakthrough, even though it doesn't sound like much, 30% efficacy. The key to that was that the research community was able then to understand how that vaccine worked. And that's something we had been working in the dark about in vaccine research for many years. We really didn't understand what kind of immune response the vaccine had to induce to protect somebody from an HIV infection. And so the results from this trial have really been a breakthrough. And the vaccine that we're testing now, the trial was already underway when those results came out, but there are enough similarities with the current vaccine we're testing and the one that was tested in Thailand that we expect to see similar results are even better. We're very hopeful about that, and of course, time will tell, but even if it shows only similar results, it will reinforce where future vaccine development has to go, and it's really, for us, it's the light at the end of the tunnel for vaccine development, because we really think now we have the right tools to develop a vaccine.
Is the search for an AIDS vaccine, this process, would you characterize it as more complicated than the search was for the polio vaccine?
It's much more complicated.
In what ways?
HIV is a chronic infection, unlike polio. Polio is an acute infection, runs its course, and it goes away. HIV is a chronic infection, stays in the body forever. And it works by, first of all, by damaging the immune system. It infects the immune system. And one of the key advantages that HIV has in causing an infection is that it mutates at a very high rate. It has a mutation rate which is a million times that of the human genome and 1,000 times that of the flu virus. And, you know, we have to have flu vaccines once every year because of that fact that the virus changes. So HIV mutates very rapidly, and the advantage of that for the virus is that it can escape our immune response. That means that when it can mutate that quickly, our immune response that's trying to eliminate it from the body does work, but it ends up selecting out viruses that can't be eliminated, because the virus is constantly producing new mutated viruses that are not susceptible to the immune response. And so while the immune response keeps trying to fight these viruses, the virus is always a step ahead of the immune system. So controlling an infection that's already underway is very, very difficult for an immune response. Whereas when you're trying to protect somebody from infection, that's a very different story. There, the virus is crossing from one person to another, and it's not actively replicating. It's not dividing. It's not making new viruses during that transmission process. So it's essentially an unchanging target, and it's much easier to stop. So, but anyway, the fact that the virus mutates so rapidly has been a real barrier to controlling it with the immune system.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guests are Mike Benner, director of the Greater Community AIDS Project, or GCAP, and Dr. Richard Novak, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We're discussing the state of HIV and AIDS research, treatment, education, and services in advance of the 25th World AIDS Day this Saturday. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-9455. WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Mike, we were talking about the fact that HIV has essentially become a chronic disease thanks to new developments and treatments. I wonder if that has had any impact on efforts to find a vaccine, a cure, and specifically funding towards that, whether or not people have sort of a different impression of HIV today, and so don't see it as vitally alarming or as something that has to be addressed today, right now. Is that an issue? Is that conversation changed?
Oh, I think so. I mean, when we're speaking with university students, I mean, they kind of take the attitude that it is something that, okay, if I do become infected, then I can just take my pill or pills every day and just carry on with my life, because we don't have that wasting the serious illnesses and things like that that they had back in the 80s and 90s. I mean, at the same time that we're trying to stress that it's not Philadelphia, the movie Philadelphia anymore,
right?
But it's still just as serious as it is then. So you're trying to have that balancing act between the two, trying to remind people that, yes, you are playing with your life, basically, by putting yourself at risk for HIV. But at the same time, if you are HIV positive, then there are things that can be helped to make your life as fulfilling as possible.
Dr. Novak, has the success in terms of research led to any limits in funding towards that research, or has it had the opposite effect, where people see that you're getting closer to a vaccine, that we're moving in that direction, and so there's more energy, more resources devoted to research?
Well, keep in mind that HIV is a worldwide problem. It's a worldwide pandemic. And it's causing the most damage in underdeveloped parts of the world, where access to care and treatment is not as widely available. It's certainly improved in the last 8 to 10 years, but it's But it's still, there are still many people who have HIV who don't have access to care. And it's a chronic illness that requires lifelong treatment. So there's still tremendous impetus to develop a vaccine. Preventing cases of HIV is ultimately going to be have a lot larger impact than chronic treatment. So there's still a lot of investment in developing vaccines for use worldwide.
How would you then describe the state of HIV/AIDS research today?
Well, I think it's still very robust. I mean, the areas that are really being focused on for the future are HIV vaccine research is still going on. It's still a major focus of the National Institutes of Health. And there's now been, in the last couple of years and going forward, there'll be a much more research dollars spent on developing a cure for HIV. That's something we really didn't think about much in past years, but it's always been the thought that HIV can't be cured because of the nature of the virus, that it's a retrovirus and it and becomes part of our genetic material. However, medical science is moving very quickly, and there's no guarantee that there's going to be a cure, but an effort to find one is underway. So that's a big push. The other things that are that are hot areas of research are trying to understand how HIV interacts with other common co-infections like tuberculosis and hepatitis C.
We're discussing HIV and AIDS research, treatment, and prevention with Dr. Richard Novak, an AIDS researcher with the University of Illinois at Chicago. Also with us is Mike Benner, director of the Greater Community AIDS Project, and you can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and we will have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Do you have a favorite recipe you always make for family gatherings? Join WILL TV in March 2013 for Family Dinner Favorites. We're collecting your recipes for our cookbook, and a few lucky cooks will prepare their recipes live on the air with us. Every recipe we receive will be included in the cookbook. So email your recipe to willmembership@illinois.edu or mail it to recipes at WILL TV, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thanks.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, truffles, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets for the holidays. Also, find specialty ingredients like saffron, smoked paprika, truffle salt, grain of paradise, and more. World Harvest Foods, 6th and University in Champaign.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the state of HIV and AIDS research, what it's like to live HIV positive, the strides taken so far in combating HIV and AIDS, and the challenges that lay ahead. My guests are Mike Benner, director of the Greater Community AIDS Project, or GCAP, and Dr. Richard Novak, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Illinois, Chicago. To join us on air, you can call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Mike, I was just reading up on a report about what's happening in China, and that hospitals there routinely reject people with HIV for surgery out of fear of exposure to the virus or harm to their reputations. This sort of underscores the fact that there are some parts of the world where we're seeing a rise in the number of HIV infections, and maybe it's in relation to that there's still a stigma associated with it around the world.
It's that, definitely is that stigma that they, people in the medical profession in those countries just don't care to really have to deal with it yet, because they just, I think a lot of it is they don't understand completely what's going on. They may be still living in the quote-unquote dark ages about the disease, or figuring that there's just something, nothing they can do about that.
What can be done about it, about this rise in parts of the world where maybe even the governments themselves are not supportive of what medicine would call for, what the medical community might call for? There have been. We certainly saw, areas of the world, countries where even political leaders would stand up and say, oh, we don't have anyone with HIV or AIDS or something like that.
I mean, I think a little bit of it takes everybody's voice, even in this country, to kind of stand up and let the leaders in Washington know that, I mean, you have to go out there and say something to these people. I mean, we have a National Institute of Health. We have Centers for Disease Control that do sway a lot of power out there in the world. And I think that by reinforcing the fact that there's issues with HIV education worldwide, hopefully that would maybe increase some of the funding to those areas.
Dr. Novak, any thoughts on this?
Well, stigma is definitely a huge problem still worldwide, and it's, you don't have to go to other countries to experience it. It's not the knowledge about HIV is much better now in the medical community, and there's less stigma in the medical community. And however, out in the communities where we serve our patients, stigma is still a major problem. It goes hand in hand with ignorance about the disease. People don't know much about it, and so they're afraid of it. And it's unfortunately a huge barrier to treatment, because people who are afraid they're going to be stigmatized don't want to be identified as having HIV. And sometimes that's to the point where they even within their own families, they don't want to be seen taking medication, so they won't. And so I agree with Mike that education is a huge part of that. In terms of international, actually, surprisingly, China is actually moving very forward with their own HIV vaccine program, which is a fairly robust research program. Areas of the Middle East are a bigger problem in terms of HIV stigma. I mean, there are countries in the Middle East where being gay itself is a crime punishable by death, and so it's very hard for people to come forward with HIV as a diagnosis and get treatment. It surprisingly even exists in countries like Iran, where it's mainly transmitted by injection drug use. But countries such as those don't want to acknowledge that they have an HIV problem.
Mike, Dr. Novak noted that you don't have to go very far to find examples of stigmas associated with HIV. I'm wondering if you can think of any examples that maybe you've come across, or folks that you've worked with through GCAP who have offered anecdotes along those lines. Anything stick out in your mind?
Oh, it's always an issue. I mean, that we here in the greater Champaign-Urbana think of ourselves as a very metropolitan area, but it doesn't take more than 10 or 15 minutes to drive outside of town when you're in very rural areas. GCAP serves an area, a 10-county area. We're down in, like, Edgar County, up in Ford County. So, I mean, it's very rural, and people just don't understand what the disease is. The people there, they have to travel a long distance to get to a medical doctor. And then there's some of the doctors that just prefer not to treat anybody with HIV. Mm-hmm. They'll just say, you need to go up to Champaign. You need to go to Indianapolis, St. Louis, or Chicago.
Can you think of, are there some specific instances where, beyond doctors, somebody's just had maybe even what might be some entertaining moments, and maybe you've had some in your own life, dealing with somebody and there's something about whether it's their demeanor or what they say or what they do that stuck with you, like, oh, that's because I have HIV that they do that?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I have several family and friends just across the state line over in Warren County, Indiana. And that's a relatively rural area. And the first time I'd appeared on TV and announced my HIV status, I was at a gathering with my in-laws. And I could definitely tell there was a little bit of standoffishness, that some people were a little bit afraid to get too close to me, especially the ones that had small children. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, over the years, I've kind of helped to destigmatize it a little bit. And that's just a small part of the community. But, I mean, I think that the real change is going to happen when more people that are actually HIV positive come out publicly about their status, so people realize that it is everywhere. That, I mean, we used to talk about the old-fashioned 7 degrees of separation. I think people today are probably separated from somebody that's HIV positive or deeply affected by HIV by less than three degrees of separation.
Well, I also wonder what impact. There have been some folks, high-profile individuals, Magic Johnson comes to mind immediately, mm-hmm. Who maybe have also helped to reduce some of that stigma?
They kind of reduced the stigma a little bit, but that was still 15 years ago that he came out with his status. I really haven't noticed anybody recently of that kind of stature that has come out, and I may be wrong, but I am inclined to believe that there may be some very prominent people out there in the world that are HIV positive but just have not announced their status.
Well, and that also raises an interesting question, which is that you have whole generations of people growing up who are living in a world or in fact, maybe it's a pretty high percentage of the population now who either have only ever lived in a world where HIV and AIDS exist, mm-hmm. Or only remember that world. I mean, anybody really under 30 at this point, 35, 30, really just doesn't know of a world other than that.
Yeah, and that's the alarming part about it. And that's the age group that has the most new infections. I mean, that is something that they've lived with all their lives, but still that they know the means to keep from contracting the illness.
So why do you think that's happening?
The visibility of youth, I think, a lot of times. Mm. I really think that has a lot to do with it, and always the thing that it can't happen to me, and also peer pressure.
Dr. Novak, would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I would agree with that, and I would add that the other issues are certainly there's complacency among youth, and there's that invincibility issue. We're seeing the most new infections among young men between ages of 18 and 25, and it's very disturbing. I'll give you an example. In our vaccine trials, where we screen people for HIV and we enroll people who don't have it, but we screen in high-risk populations, we're finding among men who have sex with men a prevalence rate of 16% overall. However, if you just look at the young African-American men between the ages of 18 and 25, the prevalence rate in our screen population is 27%. So 27% of the men who come in to be tested for the vaccine trial are positive already. that's a disturbing number that's similar to numbers you see in Southern Africa. And a good part of the reason that's happening is complacency with the disease, but also it has to do with ignorance and the unwillingness of these men to come out, to be upfront about their concerns about HIV with their partners, for partners to be who are known to be positive, to be forthcoming about it, or just not know their diagnosis. They need to be screened. But so there are a number of issues, but oftentimes men are engaging in sex without really discussing the issue of HIV with their partners, and they approach it by thinking, well, he wouldn't have sex with me if he knew he was positive. And the other one would say, well, they wouldn't allow me to have the sex, have unprotected sex, or if they're doing it, they must be negative. So I think it's an issue of being really upfront with knowing somebody's HIV status in a relationship.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions and comments for AIDS researcher Dr. Richard Novak and Mike Benner from the Greater Community AIDS Project. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. We were talking, Mike, about education sort of being the key to all of this, but we can speak in very general terms about that and say, oh, well, if people are educated and understand the disease and understand the importance of being upfront about it and various things. But is that something that needs to be targeted to specific communities where we're seeing a higher prevalence of HIV infection? And how so?
I think a lot of it's just public awareness about the disease, because if you notice around town that there's really just nothing that really reminds you that HIV is out there. I mean, it's something that they may talk about for like this 1 week of the year, since World AIDS Day is on Saturday. But then it kind of goes underneath the radar for the rest of the year. I mean, we do have numerous special days, that Latino AIDS Awareness Day, Gay Men AIDS Awareness Day, Women and Children AIDS Awareness Day, National Testing Day, all those kind of things. But they're so randomly spread out that people kind of goes back and forth underneath the radar. Part of what GCAP's mission has been changing is to just kind of put it out there for people all the time, just to kind of remind people that, yeah, it is still out here. Don't let it go underneath your radar, because it's still a deadly disease left untreated.
When we think back to the 80s and 90s, it was top of mind because so many people were dying from it. It's almost awful to say, but it's almost like that one of the benefits of that was that there was this sort of increased awareness.
There was, I mean, and there was that militant action of people that were at the forefront of looking for treatments, that were telling Washington that we want something done. We can't let our friends sit here and die. You need to do something, forcing the FDA to rapidly approve drugs, those kind of things. That, I mean, and now that we have the medications, it's just not quite the issue. I mean, even Hollywood, I mean, I look at the fact that back in the 80s, there were quite a few movies dealing with HIV out there. And now I really don't see too many that are current as of today. I mean, we may look at something that may be looking at a historic perspective, like, say, Rent or Precious, but it's not what HIV is like today in 2012.
Does it then reinforce this perception that, well, we've dealt with that? We have medication, it's chronic, therefore you can live with it, so we don't need this high awareness for it.
I think it does help fuel that that feeling with people that, I mean, that with anything, if you're not out there screaming to the top of your lungs sometimes, it just can kind of be go by the wayside. And with so many other issues out there, it's kind of difficult because in the years since HIV first surfaced, there's been major campaigns for every other kind of illness that have come along, which was something that we didn't have back in the 80s.
Dr. Novak, to get back to research, what in your mind is the best path forward for future HIV and AIDS research? Is it developing ever more refined treatment options, ever better, more effective medication to allow people to live with it as a chronic illness, or is it seeking that full-fledged cure, that vaccine?
Well, I think there are multiple avenues of research that are important. In terms of treatment, we have excellent drugs out there now. The biggest barriers to treatment are really adherence to treatment, adherence to therapy, keeping people on their medications. And so future drug development is focusing on less frequent dosing. So right now we have one pill once a day. It sounds pretty good, but maybe one day we'll have one pill once a week or have an injectable form of drug that you give once a month, so the issues of adherence won't be an issue. And so those are actually avenues that are being explored as possible futures for treatment. I think actually prevention is a more important focus of research, and we have actually had major breakthroughs in prevention developments in the last 2 or 3 years now. There are strategies that include, actually the most important one was a study that was done last year called HPTN-052, which showed that the treatment is the most potent form of prevention. If you have somebody on antiretroviral therapy and fully suppressed, they will that reduces the risk of transmitting to somebody else by 96%. So there's been a big effort by the federal government to identify more people who are infected through diagnosis and getting them on treatment. It's created a push to get people on treatment earlier in the course of the disease than ever before.
Do you think we can get to a point where no one will ever transmit this to anyone else again?
I think so. I think it's going to be a while, but I really think that's going to involve a number of prevention strategies. I do believe that vaccines are going to be a very important part of that. Because the one thing about vaccines is that you can give somebody a course of vaccines and then they're presumably done for at least some period of time, so that there's no pressure to constantly be on medication. The adherence to therapy is less of an issue. The affordability of medication has also become less of an issue.
Do you see a day when there could be an HIV vaccine that's like a TB shot or something, where it's just one of several shots you get as a child and you're taken care of for life and you won't ever...
That would be my hope.
Yeah.
That would be the goal, to get people started on it early before they become sexually active so that they would be protected for life. And they may need boosters at various times throughout their course. So that would be a goal. An example, a prototype of that, you might say, would be the HPV vaccine, human papillomavirus vaccine, which is already licensed as Gardasil, and it is recommended for young men and women before usually prepubescent is when you want to start, or before sexual activity begins. And unfortunately, even though that vaccine is essentially 100% effective in preventing cervical cancer in women, only about 40% of eligible women in the United States are getting the vaccine. Part of the concern is that it's a vaccine against a sexually transmitted infection, the virus that causes genital warts. And so parents can't look at their children who are offered the vaccine and say, my child will never be exposed to this, to a sexually transmitted infection, so why should I give them this? So there is that level of education of the population that has to happen. And so those kind of barriers will exist when an HIV vaccine is finally developed. But people look at it and say, well, my kids will never get HIV, so I'm not going to expose them to the vaccine. There's also a misconception that HIV vaccine might give you HIV. Hmm. That's a common myth that people who are participating in vaccine trials often are afraid of, which is not true, of course, but it's out there.
Mike, you mentioned, of course, Saturday is World AIDS Day. How will GCAP mark that occasion?
Well, we're going to commemorate World AIDS Day with a candlelight vigil and memorial at Westside Park from 4:30 to 5:30, where we're going to have a few speakers that we've already planned to have, plus then members of the gathering come up there and say words about how HIV has affected them in their lives over the past years.
What should people plan to do or bring or what associated with that?
Just bring themselves. It sounds like it's going to be a fairly nice evening that night. So just come with an open heart, more or less.
And otherwise, is World AIDS Day, is that sort of like pretty much, you know, the big week of the year for you?
For myself at GCAP, yes, it is. It's one of those weeks that everybody wants to hear a little bit about HIV. So I go from place to place to place. It's also a weekend that we have one of our big fundraisers also, so that kind of ties up a lot of time too, so we can act the fundraisers so we can afford to do our educational outreach.
Is there a message you try to get across during something like that candlelight vigil where you might reach out to people who you may not hear or see from the entire year?
Just to be aware of how it has affected people in the past, that there are still people living with it today, and that you never know who it might be next.
A final question for both of you. What do you most want people to think about, and what actions would you like to see taken as we approach the 25th World AIDS Day and going forward? Mike?
Keeping themselves informed as to what's going on. I mean, just realize that it is a chronic illness. There are treatments. Early detection is the key to success with the keeping the disease in check. I mean, if we can get everybody tested that is HIV positive and get all those people on their antiretroviral medications, then we will have that success that the doctors talked about of eliminating the disease.
Dr. Novak?
I would echo that, and I would say remind people that HIV is a no-fault disease. Nobody wants to have HIV. If we could get past the stigma of having the infection and just recognize it as a disease like any other, then maybe we can, then people will be more forthcoming about coming to be tested and going on therapy. Hopefully one day we'll get to that level.
And just, you know, I know there's no way to predict these sorts of things, but really how far away are we from a vaccine for HIV?
You're right. We can't, it's hard to predict that. People have made predictions about that for a long time. I think that there's quite a bit of optimism now in the HIV community and HIV vaccine development community and the research community, and we think that we're on the right track. Vaccine trials take a very long time to do. Each one takes several years. I would like to say 10, 15 years we will have it, but who knows? It could be less than that, maybe more, hopefully less. The vaccine trial that we're engaged in right now will be done in another year and a half, 2 years, and we will hopefully it will give us some good news.
That's Dr. Richard Novak, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He founded and directs the HIV Community Clinic Network, formerly the UIC HIV AIDS Project. It's a network of 8 HIV community-based clinical and research sites throughout Chicago, and he's among many researchers actively pursuing that AIDS vaccine. Dr. Novak, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Craig.
And Mike Benner is director of the Greater Community AIDS Project. GCAP will, as we discussed, host a candlelight vigil in Champaign's Westside Park this Saturday at 4:30 as part of World AIDS Day events. Community members are encouraged to come and light a candle in commemoration of those who have been lost and those who are still fighting HIV and AIDS. Mike, thank you for being with us today as well.
It's been a real pleasure, Craig. Thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. You can hear this program twice each weekday, live at 10 a.m. Central Time, then repeated weeknights at 8 on WILL AM 580. Remember, if you know somebody who might enjoy hearing Focus but they can't tune in during the day, let them know about our evening rebroadcast. Let them also know that we stream this program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. You can also sign up for our podcasts. Again, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, Kevin Waspy will join us to take your questions on personal finance, whether you're just starting out and looking for advice on investing, thinking about buying a home, sending your kids to college, or planning for retirement. Whatever the case may be, your questions will be welcome. Then on Monday, we'll spend the first Focus program of meteorological winter talking about winter weather and preparing you for the snow, sleet, ice, and snizzle. Yes, that's right, snizzle. That we may face in the coming months. Our old friend meteorologist Ed Kieser will join us to take your questions about that and really all things meteorological in nature. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.